Yeah, I think cure is our new favorite word. We don't get to say it very often.
2014 was a game-changing year for the pharma industry. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Energy right where you use it. Point of use energy generation.
You're really just a very specialized fish walking on very modified fins.
It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't?
Anesthetics are really good at what
if
they do.
If it gives people pleasure, if someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I don't know, it's a mess.
Right.
Could this be elevated potassium, but I'm afraid to say it's
actually
wrong.
To think like a soul.
I'm literally holding in my hands a human heart.
On today's show, some icy science, some heartwarming stories, and a surprising look at grief. But first up, the year in review for the pharma industry. A lot of things happened, acquisitions, layoffs, but perhaps the biggest thing was the development of a single drug for hepatitis C, sofosbuvir. Until now, the main treatment for this illness meant a daily injection of interferon for about 6 months. The side effects are tough. Some liken it to chemo, and a cure is not guaranteed. Many patients decided to monitor their disease and to postpone treatment, but all that has changed. Alana Gordon filed this story earlier this year when sofosbuvir was newly available.
Paul Yeber, a community activist, learned he had hepatitis C before it even had a name.
I was diagnosed with hepatitis non-A, non-B in 1990.
Hepatitis C didn't really surface in the medical community until the 90s, but it's the most common bloodborne disease in the U.S. For those who are chronically infected, complications may not surface for years or even decades. But over time, the virus eats away at the liver and may lead to severe scarring, liver disease, or cancer.
And I've seen people die, people I admired, people who were doing things with their life. It's a horrible way to die. There was always a tape running in the background that said, you know, you're running out of time. You know what this thing's going to do to you.
Yeber, who's 52 years old now, may soon get to hit stop on that tape. That's in part thanks to a Bucks County scientist, Mike Sophia, and more specifically to a new hepatitis C drug he co-invented called sofosbuvir.
It hit me because we were just, you know, drawing chemical structures on a piece of paper, and I looked at this one structure and I said, you know, this is the direction.
Sophia has spent the last few years zeroing in on the hepatitis C virus at a small biotech company, Pharmacet, in Princeton, New Jersey. He says one challenge that has stumped scientists for decades is how to formulate a drug so it only targets the liver without negatively affecting other parts of the body. His lab essentially figured out how to mask the drug when it's ingested and program it to only go to the liver.
And then once that drug gets to where you want it to go, this mask that's on this drug is now able to fall off because you take advantage of some property within that cell or within that organ that allows that to happen.
So once in the liver, the drug stays there and attacks the virus. It still has to be taken with other drugs, and some strains respond better than others. But so far, it boasts fewer side effects, only needs to be taken for 3 months, and has shown cure rates surpassing 90% in phase 3 clinical trials.
That set the HCV world on fire.
What we have on our hands is possibly the greatest accomplishment, public health accomplishment of our generation.
Dr. Stacy Truskin oversees care for several hundred hepatitis C patients at Drexel's partnership clinic.
Yeah, I think cure is our new favorite word. We don't get to say it very often.
The industry saw the drug's potential, too. Before it gained FDA approval, the drug company Gilead bought Pharmacet, a company of less than 100 people, for $11 billion. The move set in motion what some describe as one of the most successful drug launches in U.S. history. For Paul Yeber, it set in motion the start of treatment he'd been holding out for years.
Hi, Don Paul. How are you?
Okay. How are you, Lynelta?
All right. So this
on a recent morning, Yeber takes a seat in the office of Lynelta Nobles, a pharmacist at the Jonathan Lacks Treatment Center in Philadelphia. Nobles reviews Yeber's labs and says she's seen signs of success already.
Okay, so after 2 weeks of treatment, you actually went all the way down to less than 15 copies.
Wow.
So
that's fantastic.
Just 2 weeks of treatment.
Nobles tells Yeber adherence is critical in order for the drug to work, and also because it's not cheap. She hands him a pill box containing his next month's supply of sofosbuvir, along with other drugs.
So, Paul, just so you know, just in hepatitis C medications, this is worth $60,000.
At its retail price, the new drug is about $1,000 a pill, commonly taken once a day for 3 months in combination with another costly drug. Insurers, Medicaid agencies have been questioning the price. On the ground, many patients report having a hard time getting approved for coverage of the drug. Yaber was denied at first. Kenneth George is a pharmacist back at Drexel's Partnership Clinic.
I don't want to make the patient feel like they don't deserve to be treated with expensive medication. But I do warn the patient, it is very likely that we are going to get denied.
Whenever a product comes out and it has a very expensive price tag, it raises eyebrows.
Eric Koifel is professor of health economics at Temple University. He says companies have more leverage to set prices if they're first to develop and patent a drug. But that encourages them to take risks to develop a product over years that may very likely fail and not get approved. But Koifel says the challenge with this new hepatitis C drug is that millions of people could potentially benefit from it.
And the question then becomes, how are we going to pay for all that?
The drug company Gilead defends the price. It points to the long-term benefits of a short-term treatment. It's a one-time regimen that can rid a person of hepatitis C without the need for a costly liver transplant down the road. The company also stresses that existing treatments are already expensive. Koifel thinks once a new wave of drugs makes it through the pipeline, and that is expected soon, the price of sofosbuvir may go down. At the end of his visit with the pharmacist, Paul Yaber places that next round of expensive medicine in his backpack and heads out the door.
Thank you. I'm now going to be living a life without the threat of death by hepatitis C.
Are you laughing because it's kind of funny to say that, like in this context, or what's going through your mind?
I'm laughing because I'm happy. I'm laughing out of joy. You know, it's like this has been a long battle.
And since I first reported this story last June, I've talked with Paul, and he tells me that the virus is undetectable since he completed his regimen. So he has even more reason to be happy.
And Alana Gordon, great story, obviously, about one man's cure. But what does the development of this drug mean for the pharma industry on a bigger scale?
So I've talked with a lot of people in the industry who say, in some ways, 2014 was kind of the year of Sovaldi, or sofosbuvir, as we call it, because it really brought to the surface a debate that has been going on in the U.S., but it really heightened around drug pricing and how the cost of drugs, how high it is, depending on who you talk to. We saw here in Philadelphia recently, a few weeks ago, SEPTA, the regional transit agency, actually sued Gilead over the price of this drug. So it's really raising, again, this national debate over drug pricing. Now, what's come of that, I don't know. We will see. But it's really brought to the surface some of these really important issues within the pharma industry.
Another big topic in 2014 was Ebola. What role did the pharma industry play in combating this disease?
So I think that Ebola also raises some really important ethical issues and scientific development issues around vaccines. With Ebola, what we saw is a huge fast-tracking of the vaccine development process in a way that we haven't seen in a long time, because typically it can take many, many years for a vaccine to develop. But what we saw over this last year was the government, the World Health Organization, really stepping in with pharma companies and encouraging them to speed along that process, whether that's through accelerating clinical trials, providing more of the funding and support for that to happen. So this is all in the works. We're going to see what's happening in the next few weeks and months, how far along this can come. But it also raises some questions around when you have a public health emergency or when you have something that affects, for example, a small group of people, let's say in a developing country, where the incentives are or where pharma, big pharma, comes into play to develop those treatments. Now, obviously, Ebola is a big public health emergency, so it's been getting a lot of focus in that regard.
And a lot of people were asking, how come we don't have a vaccine already? How come we don't have a treatment already? So there was certainly some criticism there, too.
Absolutely. And there had been research and progress along a vaccine years ago. But for a variety of reasons, including funding and depending on how you look at whose role that is, whether it's the pharma industry's role to develop these sorts of things or what kind of incentives are in place or whether they're not doing their role, nothing came of that.
We heard a lot about restructuring in different pharma companies, especially in our region, some layoffs. What's happening with that?
Yeah, well, we heard recently about GlaxoSmithKline. It's been reorganizing and restructuring, some big changes coming to the Research Triangle area in North Carolina, also affecting the Philadelphia region. Basically, big pharma companies, whether it's Merck or GlaxoSmithKline, are all going through a major restructuring. It's been happening for a while, but part of what's happening is the big research and development pipelines, that big early development, a lot of that is being shed. And instead, kind of these companies are focusing on some core projects or acquiring things that are already in the process from smaller biotech companies. So we're seeing a lot of that restructuring and shakeups. On the flip side, we also saw some recent developments this last year in terms of U.S. tax policies and how that influences whether companies acquire others that have a base outside the U.S. for certain tax deals. We saw a lot of these questions raised as Pfizer looked to buy out AstraZeneca, which is not based in the U.S., but it has a strong presence in Wilmington. So these are all interesting questions that have come up in developments in terms of the whole shakeup of the industry.
And Alana, what are some of the buzzwords we might be hearing when it comes to the pharma industry in 2015?
Well, I'm going to be really curious to see what happens around the whole aspect of gene editing. We've seen some really fascinating stuff happen in the last few years along those lines. It's some really cutting-edge technology, and there's, you know, whether it's MIT and other places that are working on some immunotherapy treatments as it relates to this. So I'm going to be keeping an eye on that. It's CRISPR is one of the examples. And I'm also going to be trying to keep an eye on something called biosimilars, which is basically using a biological process to create a drug. But it's also looking at how to replicate that and whether the industry, whether generics can come in and replicate those products for a whole other new market for those kinds of drugs. And typically that hasn't been able to happen in the U.S., but we may start seeing that to change. It's all happening within the FDA right now, figuring out that approval process.
Alana Gordon, you'll keep us updated next year. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, things get a little frosty here on the Pulse, but beware, not all that slippery is ice.
And then I just go around the panels, I spray a layer on. And it doesn't need to be completely covered. When your skate gets in the solution, it just glides right through.
Still to come on the Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. It's the end of the year. It's the holidays. It's winter. I know. I'm stating the obvious. But think about this. A favorite activity this time of year is ice skating. And guess what? You don't even really need ice. Here's a piece from last December done by Pulse contributor Avir Mitra. And Avir was exploring some other slippery options.
Today I'm at the piazza in Northern Liberties, where they set up an ice skating rink for the winter. But there's something different about the ice.
It's artificial ice.
That's right. Everyone's ice skating using regular ice skates, but there's no ice. The rink isn't frozen, it doesn't melt, but somehow people are slipping and sliding on it. Now, I'm not a professional figure skater, but this is confusing. So here I am with the guy who made the rink.
My name is Stephen Murphy. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I work for a company called Artificial Ice Events.
So how do you build an artificial ice skating rink? What's the process?
I can show you how it's put together if you want.
Yeah, sounds cool.
Steven takes me to a separate room where he has some spare parts of the rink lying around.
It's like putting a piece of puzzle together. It comes in 4x8 panels.
What are these panels made out of?
It's a plastic polymer material. The best thing I can compare it to would be like a cutting board that you have in your kitchen.
He throws the panels on the floor and starts hammering them into place.
Okay, so I'm standing on this synthetic surface, but actually it's not really slippery at all.
Without solution, it isn't slippery the slightest bit. It's called propylene glycol.
Propylene glycol is acting as a lubricant, so when Steven sprays it on a smooth, flat surface, you can glide across that surface without much friction. What makes propylene glycol especially useful compared to other lubricants such as engine oil is that it is uniquely compatible with our biology. In other words, it's not toxic.
It doesn't irritate the skin in any way. If you ingest it, it's not an issue. It's not going to cause you to vomit or feel nauseous or anything. It's not going to irritate your skin, your eyes, anything.
In fact, propylene glycol is used as a non-active ingredient in all sorts of products. You can find it in soaps, shampoos, toothpaste, cough syrup, cookies, beer, the list goes on. It's even used in e-cigarettes.
So I pump up the sprayer so it builds pressure inside. And then I just go around the panels and I spray a layer on it. And it doesn't need to be completely covered. When your skate gets in the solution, it just glides right through.
So it turns out the science of artificial ice isn't all that complicated. Throw some lubricant on a flat surface and you can skate. Real ice skating, on the other hand, is actually more interesting. I spoke with Songgang Chu, a professor of mechanical engineering at Temple University. As Dr. Chu explained it to me, ice isn't actually slippery. It's actually a very tiny layer of water on top of the ice that we're slipping on.
I used to live in Minnesota, and driving over there, sometimes was hot, but most time was okay, because the temperature over there was extremely low, right? And so it's ice is extremely rigid. In that case, you will find out it's not too bad. The worst case is that when temperature gets about right, say, just under the freezing temperature, so the ice is not pure ice. It has both ice and water on the surface. That makes driving so hard.
With ice and water, nature has created a perfect scenario for skating. Ice is a smooth surface that constantly provides its own lubricant. And when your skates scratch into the surface, the water can freeze and make the surface smooth again. But there are some benefits to artificial ice.
It's a 10% drag on your skate. I know a lot of NHL goaltenders, they actually train on this stuff. And a lot of Olympic speed skaters train on it.
So it's like running with weights or something?
Exactly.
I caught up with family on the rink.
Rachel.
Hey, John Davidson.
And Emma.
How is it? I see you guys kind of slipping around on these ice skates.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. It's not real ice, so it's very strange.
What do you think of this ground right here?
To pretend.
It's pretend ice.
Even she knows. She's smart.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
My snowflakes are crowded the corners, and I think it's time to drink, don't you think?
Sticking with our icy theme for the moment, most of us dread snow on some level because it means crowded grocery stores, messy roads, terrible commutes, and on. But contemplate for one moment the pristine beauty of a single snowflake. Tanya English reports on how they get their unique shapes.
Snowflakes start as a water vapor in the clouds. When conditions are right, super cooled, and well below freezing, the vapor morphs directly into a solid snow crystal. Soon, other water vapor adds on.
Water molecules just get jostled around in the air until they find their way to the snowflake.
Ken Liebrecht is a physicist at the California Institute of Technology. He says at first, the crystal is squat and compact. It's nothing like the shapes you'd see on a Christmas card. But because of the way H2O molecules bond together, the crystals have six sides right from the start.
And this is partly why the snowflake forms branches, is that the tips of, say, a hexagon will stick out a little farther into the air, and the water vapor will get to the tip more quickly than it gets to other parts of the crystals.
And so on and so on.
And eventually they become heavy enough that they fall down.
Different temperatures and humidity conditions give a growing snow crystal its shape. it could become a familiar lacy star. But a snowflake can just as easily grow to look like a six-sided pencil. There's lots of surface physics to still figure out.
It's not that one has any practical applications of this. You just want to see if you can understand what's happening in nature.
Liebrecht studies and photographs snowflakes outside.
I will let snowflakes fall onto a piece of cardboard, and I'll watch and sort of look around for nice-looking specimens. And then I'll, if I see one, I'll pick it up using a little paintbrush and drop it onto a glass slide.
Meanwhile, mathematician Janko Grovner creates virtual snowflakes on his computer at the University of California in Davis.
You know, nobody can hang in the cloud and with a microscope and just see how the snowflakes form. They cannot just appear at random because the snowflakes are so symmetric.
Grovner models the tiny temperature shifts that snowflakes encounter as they grow. If we could just read their patterns, he says, we'd have a small history of where a snowflake has traveled. So, is it true that no two snowflakes are alike?
I knew you were going to ask me that question.
Grovner says technically two crystals could be identical, but it's extremely unlikely. Consider again all the different atmospheric conditions in a cloud. Even two snowflakes, forming right next to each other, experience the trip differently. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique, like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you can see. And now after some thinking, I'd say I'd rather be a function.
And one more frozen entry during this portion of The Pulse. Physicist Tom Geiser of the University of Delaware studies neutrinos, and he helped set up a big research station at the South Pole. Here he describes what it's like to spend the holidays there.
There's a race around the world, for example. It's easy to go around the world at the South Pole because it's a pole, and you just... But people make it very elaborate. They make floats like out of bicycles, or people ski. And there's some serious runners who actually try to win the race. But it's basically just a nice party, I think. The food is good in Antarctica. We do play pool or sit around and have a drink and socialize. So it's a very pleasant environment. And you meet people from... some of the most interesting people at the South Pole are the bulldozer drivers who manage the snow. You know, the snow, although there's not much precipitation, the snow does drift because of the wind during the winter. And so when the station is opened, they start moving the snow out of the way. Megan Whitmore is my favorite bulldozer driver. She's a woman who's about, I don't know, 5 feet 2 inches tall or something, and she drives a big 15-foot bulldozer around very skillfully.
Tom Geiser is a physicist at the University of Delaware, and he was describing the holiday season at the South Pole during one of our So What Do You Do conversations. By the way, if you want to be part of that, send us an email at thepulse@whyy.org. We're taking a look back over the year 2014 today, and joining us now is Cary Grenz. She's an associate editor for The Scientist, and usually we talk to Cary about some of the latest findings and studies, but today Cary actually wanted to talk about the biggest science busts of the year. Hi, Cary.
Hi, Maiken.
So what are your favorite busts, if I shall call it that?
Well, we can frame it as, you know, opportunities to learn some lessons. And 2014 was not all bad, but there were certainly some setbacks this year. One of the big ones in the life sciences was a new method to generate stem cells from another type of mouse cell. And it was simple, it was quick, it was efficient, but as it turned out, it was partially fabricated by one of the researchers. So it was this big, splashy technique that people were super excited about, and it ended up being seriously flawed. That scientist was exposed for her misconduct, but it had an enormous impact on the field. The Riken Institute in Japan, where some of the collaborators were based, conducted a huge investigation, ended up actually restructuring the organization of the center where the research took place. And it is continuing a very critical look now at the peer review process and how these studies actually made it into Nature magazine to begin with. Following, you know, the news coverage of this, people discovered that these studies on this technique, it's called STEP, had actually been submitted to other journals first and had been rejected. So there was this question about how did it slip through? And then tragically, one of the researchers involved in these studies had committed suicide. And there's been considerable speculation that this saga had something to do with it.
And Carrie, how did it come out that this was in part fabricated?
A few ways. One was that people tried to replicate this technique because it was so simple and so spectacular. You know, of course, scientists are skeptics. They tried to do it themselves and they couldn't figure it out. It couldn't work for them. And then people also started noticing that some of the images in the paper seemed to look a little fishy. And so then that prompted an investigation that eventually exposed that this woman involved in the studies had, you know, manipulated some of the data.
And are any of the findings valuable at all, or is that entire research basically worthless?
Some of the researchers involved do stand by the technique. They say that the protocol just needs to be tweaked a bit, and they're updating the protocol and sharing it with the community to try and get this to work. So they stand by it. I don't know that the broader stem cell community accepts it. So I think that still has to be worked out. But I don't know that all is lost just yet.
Now, Carrie, your second bust pick for 2014 is something we talked about previously on The Pulse, the safety lapses at the CDC.
Yes, it was quite an eventful year when it came to biosafety problems. For one, a researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, mailed a dangerous strain of bird flu mistakenly to a U.S. Department of Agriculture lab. In another case, the bacteria that caused anthrax had been transferred to a lab that wasn't equipped to deal with it, and people actually were exposed. Nobody got sick, fortunately. And then in another instance, long-forgotten smallpox vials were discovered in storage at the National Institutes of Health. It was merely by accident. No one even knew they were there. All of these cases, of course, raised the alarm bells on biosafety at these federal labs. And interestingly, they all seemed to cluster in 2014.
And what has been learned from those incidents? Has anything changed?
Well, critics, of course, say that this has exposed a sort of lax attitude toward biosafety at these labs. And, you know, we're kind of picking on the federal labs here because these cases were exposed, but this may be a broader sort of culture of lax safety. It's not entirely clear, but there have been some actions taken. The CDC ended up blocking their labs from transferring hazardous materials until it could shore up its safety protocols, and new task forces have been deployed to focus on safety.
And Carrie, finally, 2014 was also a tough year for space exploration.
Yeah, so in October, a rocket bound for the International Space Station exploded shortly after takeoff. Fortunately, no one was on board. It was just carrying cargo and science supplies. But $200 million worth of equipment just went up in flames. One of the other tragic things, aside from the monetary loss, was that students who had loaded their science experiments on board watched the whole thing. And it was really dramatic. It just blew up in a giant fireball seconds after takeoff. There were a bunch of different student projects, but actually there's a local one. High schoolers in Ocean City, New Jersey, had put some equipment on board to study how bacteria colonize lettuce in microgravity.
And of course, that was not the only incident in terms of commercial space exploration. But Carrie, do you think those students in the first incident will get a chance to get their science projects into space?
Yes, as I understand it, the students will get another chance to send their experiments up into space.
Carrie, of course, this wasn't an all-around bad year for science at all. What are some of your favorite positive findings and successes from this year?
Oh, yeah. The list would be far longer than the setbacks, for sure. I'm not a total Grinch about 2014. I will say one of the highlights was actually the last time we spoke, the European Space Agency had just plopped a lander on a comet. That was really a spectacular achievement of 2014. I think synthetic biology made some really great headway this year. That's when you're designing molecules or DNA or cells in a lab. Biologists created the first synthetic chromosome in yeast. They also designed artificial enzymes, and they made a synthetic DNA molecule that actually works inside bacterial cells. In other fields, we found genes related to autism. Researchers have grown organs in the laboratory, and the list goes on.
And Carrie, you'll continue to keep us informed in 2015, and we look forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Maiken.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor for The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. Now, we just heard about a bunch of science busts that happened in 2014, and we tend to look at failure as a negative thing, but there's much to be learned when things go wrong. Generations of children learned all about things going wrong and about science through their chemistry sets.
The all-new, completely different Gilbert chemistry sets, with a volcano that erupts, a fire extinguisher you make yourself.
Whatever happened to this once-prized toy? Zach Seward went to find out.
Jennifer Landry is opening an atomic energy chemistry set from the late 50s. She's the director of the Chemical Heritage Foundation Museum, which has the largest chemistry set collection in the U.S.
What's interesting is it does have uranium ore in it, as well as a radioactive screen, you know, so you'd be safe. You have your radioactive screen, it's okay.
Is having uranium ore really bad for you? Or is it not that bad?
I wouldn't ingest it.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation here in Philadelphia has over 100 chemistry sets, uranium ore, polyvinyl chloride, and all. They come with dangerous-sounding chemicals, small pieces of lab equipment, and a license to experiment. Landry has pulled about a dozen or so from the stacks, including this one from 1917.
But yeah, so mysterious experiments in chemical magic, magic links appear and disappear, beautiful color changes occur, and many other marvelous transformations are promised out of this set.
The collection has a chemistry set that dates all the way back to the 1850s, but they really started gaining in popularity as educational toys in the 1930s and 40s. After World War II, America's interest in chemistry sets really took off, buoyed by a growing conviction that science meant progress. Landry says back then, science was just cool to both parents and kids alike.
If you're writing out your Christmas wish list, the chemistry set was often one of the top items on the list. That's probably not the case today.
So I guess my question is, who killed the chemistry set? You know, these were popular. These were under every Christmas tree. And then all of a sudden they weren't. When did that happen and why?
So you see the decline start in the late 60s and then into the 70s. And it's a combination of things. It's, public attitude towards science change. Silent Spring by Rachel Carson came out in the early 60s. And we became a lot more environmentally aware. And then you also have this concern for safety, the rise of sort of, you know, legal knowledge and, you know, concerns about lawsuits and then just childhood safety.
Times change, basically. We move on. But the big picture has some in the science community concerned. They say generations of leading scientists and engineers fell in love with the field through their childhood chemistry sets. Making stink bombs and accidentally torching curtains actually served a purpose, letting children explore and innovate in a tangible way. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
Coming up on The Pulse, what do your friends really need when they are dealing with illness and grief?
What I needed was for people to let me breathe, to let me be the other parts of Jill, not the Jill who's the wife of the sick man Jill, but the Jill who likes to talk about books.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
¶¶ Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. It's the holidays and the end of the year, and usually a time when we think about the things that are really important to us. What really matters? Along those lines, let's listen back to a story from our series, Patient Files. Here are 13-year-old Elise Nichols and her grandmother, Deborah Danzler, of West Philadelphia. Danzler has diabetes, but her illness has brought her closer to her granddaughter.
I've been type 2 diabetic over 10 years now. I'm diagnosed as complex, so my diabetes is really hard to control. I take two types of insulin, and I also take medication. And that's a lot, you know. It's a lot to do on a daily basis. After school, Elise comes over to my house every day, so I always have her. You know, she stays the night at my house on weekends. She sees me one-on-one all the time. She used to see me at the table, you know, taking my insulin, and she just got curious one day and said, well, why are you doing that? Why do you do it every day?
And I didn't know what she was taking it for, so I kept asking her questions, and she had told me it was her diabetes. At first, I felt a little scared because I heard that some people die by diabetes, and that's when I wanted to help out.
My grandkids keep me encouraged and inspired to try to manage it more better because at one time, you know, it was completely out of control. I mean, my eating habits were bad. Anything you eat affects diabetes, what you drink. Diabetes is a disease that you can't take time off from. There's not a day that I can say, today I don't have to take my medicine, today I can eat what I want. You have to be on point every single day.
Sometimes when it's time to eat, like lunch or dinner, I'm like, come on in, you gotta eat. Sometimes some people like forget or they might be late. I'm like, come on in, let's eat. Or when we go out to eat, I'll try to remind her to bring her medicine. I try to keep her active. Sometimes she'll take me to the park. We'll play like frisbee or like, I think it was tennis or bad racket. I think.
Badminton. Another good activity we do together is water aerobics. I joined the YMCA recently. And she has a membership with me, so she'll go with me. Water aerobics is excellent for people that have diabetes but have other, you know, limitations. You know, you're weightless in the water, so you can do a lot of different exercise and activities without hurting any part of your body.
I love it because I love water. I like swimming all the time. So I like doing the water aerobics because I'm, like, spending more time with my Nana. Sometimes I splash her, get on the nerves.
I don't like to be splashed. I don't like water splashing in my face. And she loves it because she likes to see me get, she thinks I look funny when I get upset. It's really been up and down for me. The diabetes has affected my life in a lot of ways, emotionally and physically. Things that I used to do, no longer can do it or I'm limited in doing it. Because I've seen from the last 10 years to now how drastically my life has changed. I was a working, you know, productive person working in telecommunications for 25 years, the same job. And I just watched one thing after another kind of like happen. And to the point where I'm currently disabled. Some days my spirit is not up. She'll pick up on that. You're having a bad day, Nana, you know, and then I'll explain to her, you know, what it is and why I'm going through.
One thing I know is I just got to be by her side the whole time and make sure she's doing okay.
Elise has helped inspire me to really not give up.
Never give up, and you just got to keep on trying, and I'm there every step of the way.
I think she was a blessing the day she was born, the day that she was born into my life. I love you, Elise, and thank you for being my inspiration.
I love you, Nana.
13-year-old Elise Nichols and her grandmother, Deborah Danzler, who has diabetes. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. When friends or loved ones are affected by serious illness, we want to make sure we're there for them, right? Especially during the holiday season. But are we saying the right things? Writer Jill Smolo learned a lot about suffering and grief in a short period of time and describes her experiences in her book, Four Funerals and a Wedding. She says after her husband Joe was diagnosed with leukemia, her friends' well-meaning efforts weren't always so helpful.
The thing is, when you get caught in a moment like this, everybody around you starts behaving in a way you are not familiar with. All they want to know is, how are you? How's Joe? How's your daughter, Becky? And it's very hard to get them off of that conversation, which is an expression of concern, of course, and I appreciated the concern, but it's very repetitive. And it's very draining. And in very little time, I began to feel like I had to reassure them I'm okay. Like they needed comfort. That's not useful.
If I were talking with you as a friend and you were talking about, let's say, your dog, but I know your husband is dying, then I might say things like, well, but how are you really? Or what's really happening?
I'm smiling as you're saying it because that's exactly what I heard. And it also includes the grab my arm. No, really, you can tell me. And what I needed was for people to let me breathe, to let me be the other parts of Jill, not the Jill who's the wife of the sick man Jill, but the Jill who likes to talk about books, you know, the Jill who likes to argue about politics and walk my dog and be with my daughter and hear about my friend's problems. So I had to start being very specific with my friends and say to them, please, I want to go for walks. I want to hear about what you're writing. I want to hear about your kids. I want to hear about whatever you're thinking about. I don't want to talk about Joe. And it was very hard to convince people I really meant it because, I mean, one of my closest friends, for instance, she came back from a vacation and I'm grilling her with questions about the vacation. And the next day she called me up sounding absolutely agonized. I was like, what's the matter? She says, I can't believe I told you about my vacation. That was so inconsiderate. I was like, I went ballistic. You've got to be kidding me. You know, we were like a year and a half into this drama already. She still didn't understand. I really wanted to hear about her vacation. So I just kept trying to push the boundaries out and push the boundaries out, which having had a lot of practice at it over the 2.5 years, then when Joe actually did die, I already was familiar with the coping mechanisms that worked best for me. And they didn't change. You know, it was very much the same thing. I didn't want to be the widow. I was a widow. I didn't need reminding that I was a widow.
Unfortunately, the loss of your husband was not the only loss you experienced during a very short period of time. You lost your sister, too.
I lost my sister, my mother, and my mother-in-law all within 17 months of losing Joe. And with my sister, my mother and mother-in-law, they were aging. It wasn't shocking. But my sister was only 49, diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. That was very difficult. Here's the irony. When she got sick, now I was back in the position all of my friends were. I wanted to ask her every phone call, every minute, how are you? How are you? How are you? And I really had to learn all over again how to restrain myself and tune into what her needs were. And her needs were not unlike mine. She absolutely wanted to talk about something else.
But as humans, it's hard. We really have to restrain ourselves from having those responses, because obviously as humans, we care about the other person.
Well, we do. But here's the thing that I've learned about grief, having been through many iterations of it in such a short period of time. And it's also what the modern bereavement research shows. Most of us are what's called resilient, which means that we experience our grief in waves. You know, like I'm having a lovely conversation right now with Mike, and then I go out and think, oh, I miss Joe, and then I have a nice lunch. My mood goes up and down. That's what helps us tolerate the grief. The cultural script that we have assumes that, no, you're sunk in sorrow every minute, and it doesn't allow for the possibility that you're experiencing pleasure, that you're able to pull from other parts of your life to continue moving forward. And I think that the reason I wrote the book was because I wanted to put out a portrait of what this idea, this concept of resilience means. Not to say do it my way. I absolutely am not saying that. What I'm saying is don't let people's assumptions so hem you in that you can't figure out what you need for yourself. And for the people who want to help you, they shouldn't assume that the how are you thing is all that there is. Follow the cues of the person who's actually grieving. You may be pleasantly surprised by other things that they want from you that are very, very useful.
Jill Smolo is a journalist and writer. Her latest book is Four Funerals and a Wedding. And now, to end the show on a note of inspiration, here's the story of a Philadelphia musician and producer who has had a life-threatening illness for as long as he can remember, yet he thrives and creates despite it all.
My name is Brian McTeer. I'm a musician, recording studio owner, and I run a music nonprofit called Weather Vane Music. So it's cool. It's totally awesome. I have cystic fibrosis. It's a genetic disease. It primarily affects it affects all systems of the body, but I think the most problematic places, at least to start, you know, are the respiratory system and the digestive system. People with CF are constantly battling lung infection. For many people, it is the battle they lose, you know. Every morning and every night, I do about a 45-minute to an hour-long regimen of inhaled medications. They're like a mixture of mucolytics to bring mucus up and out of my lungs and antibiotics. So that's twice a day. On top of that, I take digestive enzymes with my meals. Oh, my newest gig is that I'm pre-diabetic with a type of diabetes that comes along with cystic fibrosis. So I've also started taking insulin before I eat. This is one of my pill bottles. This is for my digestive enzymes. I sort of decided I wanted to make different shakers, different percussion instruments out of my pill bottles. And I have I take a huge list of medications. I mean, it's insane. There's probably 20 or 30 different things I take. So I kind of aspire to, you know, making a whole set of shakers that no other studio in the world has, because they're basically based off of my medications. Sounds great, you know? I think I put lentils in it. Maybe it was rice. Oh, yeah, no, it's quinoa and a little bit of lentils. When I was a little kid, nobody believes me when I say this, even to this day, but when I was a little kid, cystic fibrosis did not have a negative connotation. First of all, I was very healthy, despite the fact that I had cystic fibrosis. I got a day off from school every 2 months to go down to Children's Hospital. It'd be high fives all around. They'd be saying, "You're doing so great." I was just getting praised, you know? It wasn't really till I was probably 30-something that I really started to kind of, like, be a little bit angry at the idea of having this condition. Sorry it's I got really sick when I was 36. My lungs just felt like they were shutting down, you know? And for the first time in my life, I was really thinking of, like, the limitations on my life. When I was diagnosed at 2.5, the life expectancy was about 4 to 6. When I turned 6, the life expectancy was about 8. When I turned 8, it was about 12. When I was 12, about 20. When I turned 37, it was 37. And then I turned 38, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm kind of, you know, past due, right? And then they just upped it to 40, you know? So I've been what they call chasing life expectancy my whole life, you know? But what that means is, like, the treatment of cystic fibrosis is, like, a runaway success. I'm 41. I just was curious about organ transplants. But my doctor, he said, talk to me in 15, maybe 20 years. And I said, 15 or 20 years, that's a long time. I might not be here in 15 or 20 years. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you'll definitely be here in 15 or 20 years. And you have no idea what kind of a weight off of my shoulders that was. I'll never forget driving home from that appointment. And for the first time in my life, imagining myself being 55 or 60 years old.
Brian McTeer is a musician and producer. He heads the Philadelphia nonprofit organization Weather Vane Music, which supports independent artists. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows from this entire year, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your ideas, and your questions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott, and next time I'll see you, it will be 2015. So I wish you all a happy and healthy new year.